Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to author G.D. Grace's A Touch of Grace, Literary Magic, on Blog Talk Radio.
One day I saw my reflection. On my face was fear. I was afraid of who I was, afraid to let others know. I was an outcast of society. My sexual identity was an abomination. I had a one-way ticket straight to hell. My natural desires were forbidden. I felt so alone. I felt unloved. I was my father's nightmare. I was my mother's mistake. I was opposite of normal. I was in every family's disgrace. One day, I changed that reflection. It's Saturday, October 5th, 2013. I am your host, GD. Welcome, listeners, to A Touch of Grace. This is the interview I've been looking forward to this season. I have adored his literary works for years. In 1994, his breakthrough novel, B-Boy Blues, landed on bookshelves, giving a voice to a generation of same-gender loving men of color. The characters Raheem Rivers, Mitchell Crawford, better known as Pookie and Little Bit, became the role model couple for hopeless romantics. Mitchell was the gay middle-class professional who meets and falls in love with the unpolished homo thug Raheem. Raheem is pretty much every gay man's fantasy. He is masculine with the body of an Adonis, and his strikingly handsome looks parallel a surprisingly sharp intellect that captures the heart of Mitchell Crawford. If true love is your thing, then B-Boy Blues delivers. Now, without further ado, listeners, I present to you the talented author and playwright, James Earl Hardy. James, welcome to the show. How are you doing this morning?
Thank you so much for the invitation. I'm doing quite well. And yourself?
You know what? I'm doing very well. I'm just really jazzed and happy inside to be talking to someone that I have admired their work for so many years. You're just phenomenal. So can you tell us where it all began?
Well, I guess the it you're referring to is B-Boy Blues.
That's correct. Thanks for that help. Yeah, I'm referring to B-Boy Blues.
Well, the very short story is that I was working at Newsweek magazine in the arts department, and this was the summer of 1993, and one of my tasks they called me a research fellow, but that was just a fancy way of saying intern, was to read books that the staff editor, writer, or freelance book reviewers would consider. And after a few weeks of doing that, well, I became severely depressed because I did not see myself in anything. And so it finally dawned on me, I guess they call it an epiphany, that if I wanted to see a book on a bookshelf that reflected my life and the lives of the SGL brothers that I knew, I would have to write it myself. And hence, over the next 3 months, and literally it's been 20 years since that epiphany, B-Boy Blues was born.
Okay, and I could certainly relate to that, because between you and Elon Harris, I had really not seen anything about our books. I know that James Baldwin was out there, but I didn't know about him until later in life. Plus, me reading James Baldwin, as far as my maturity and understanding of, who I was, I was not there. But I tell you, when I picked up B-Boy Blues, it was a very easy read, and the characters were very lovable and real to me. So when you sat down and you wrote that first page of B-Boy Blues, did you already have those characters pegged? Did you know who they would be?
I didn't. writing B-Boy Blues was very much an out-of-body experience for me. They say that everyone has at least one book in them. The most difficult task is allowing it to come out. I really believe that the ancestors were working with me, that I believe I was the very first person to ever write a story like B-Boy Blues. I was just the very first person to get one published.
Mm-hmm.
And I would write a chapter, and then I would just be so surprised because I didn't know where it came from. and certainly part of the problem was that I was standing in my own way. Because for years, like many other brothers I knew, I would complain about not seeing a black-on-black love story that featured us. Because, as we know, the history previously before B-Boy, the template was to find a black gay man in the arms in the world of a white gay man. And certainly there was no inkling that a homeboy, a roughneck, a thug could be gay.
Exactly.
So all I did was merge those concepts.
And as you know, because B-Boy Blues, if I'm not mistaken, it was back in 1994 when it was released. Once you had that finished product in your hand, how was the shopping it around process? How did that go? Was it hard or was it easy to get somebody to pick it up?
Well, no one wanted to touch it for various reasons. Most specifically because a story like it hadn't appeared before. So white publishers, black publishers, straight publishers, gay publishers, just were not sure that the title had any commercial viability, which was usually the phrase that was used in the 36 rejection letters I received. but, you know, Sasha Allison at Allison Books knew that just because a story like it hadn't appeared before didn't mean there wasn't an audience for it. And he published In Life and Brother to Brother, the two groundbreaking black gay male anthologies. So it was just a question of getting it in the right hands, of finding that audience. So,
thank you for that. I was always interested to know about that because you are one of the groundbreaking writers out there for this genre of writing. I always wondered what it was like for you, and did you know, or when did you know that B-Boy Blues was a success? Was there a moment in time when you realized what you had done?
It was probably when I got a call from USA Today.
Well, all righty then.
Because they wanted to interview me for a feature story. Clearly, the novel was making a lot of noise outside of black SGL circles. And they wanted to profile me, which was rather surprising because, yes, I was, you know, an upstart. This was my debut. I was published by a very small gay and lesbian press that used to be in Boston, but now Allison is in Los Angeles. And the first printing for B-Boy Blues was just 5,000 copies. So it wasn't as if we had a serious promotional or media push for the novel. It was very much word of mouth, but clearly that word of mouth worked because by the time I got the call from USA Today, the first printing was gone. And even Allison, Sasha himself, was kind of surprised because I believe that the average sales for gay novels, at least at that time, was maybe 15,000-20,000 copies. And to sell 5,000 in a month and a half.
Wow.
That's unheard of. So,
outside of the USA, outside of the United States, what did that happen parallel with what was taking place in the United States for B-Boy Blues, or did that come later?
Well, there was a ripple effect, as with many people here in the States, because Allison was a small publisher. There were certain points where they couldn't keep up with the demand. And
oh.
So what people would do was that they would, if someone in another state couldn't find a copy of the book, they would mail them their copy.
Oh, wow, that is fantastic.
Then they would buy another one. And I found out a few years later when I began to receive, literally letters from people in Tokyo, in London, in Paris, in Johannesburg, that someone from the States mailed them the book. Yeah, there was definitely an international thing going on.
And I would imagine with global success that you've been having, was there ever a time when you paused and said, oh, my God, here I am in the center of this that I have created. And was there, because at that particular point in time, I'm pretty sure that people were really looking up to you and people were clamoring for you, I'm pretty sure by that time. Was there ever a moment in time when you realized, oh, my God, what did I do?
I think the reaction was more, I can't believe that the book has received the type of attention that it has. Because I really believe that, well, I wrote it, you know, that maybe it'll sell 5,000 copies. And I was, you know, content with that and went back to my duties at Newsweek and my freelance writing career. I had no intention. There wasn't supposed to be a B-Boy Blue series. That was not my goal. But once again, a little bit of another idea. So the surprise is that 20 years later, I'm still talking about Pookie a little bit, and there are still more stories to tell.
You know what's funny is that, you know what's funny, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Did you have another point that you wanted to make on that note?
Oh, no, that's fine.
Okay. Well, you know, I guess I read B-Boy Blues, and then second time around was, of course, told from the perspective of Raheem. And then there was another one that I read was If Only for One Night, and that's when he goes back to his high school reunion, which I thought your books, it's not like they're overcomplicated to read. They're just perfect. I mean, and that's what sucks you into those stories. And I know that the original B-Boy Blues got a lot of notoriety, but I actually had to find out about the others. I was doing a search on the internet. The internet has just made things more reachable for everybody to find, because a lot of stuff gets buried in mainstream stuff. So you mentioned you never thought that it would be a series, but I have a question to ask. You contributed to the Elin Harris tribute book, Visible Lives.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a story in there that extended where Pookie and Little Bit were. It teased me because of course, when you're reading your books, James, you always want more. So is there going to be another B-Boy Blues? I'm asking, man.
Well, yeah, there will be an eighth title in the series called Men of the House. It will be out probably later next year around B-Boy Blues' official 20th anniversary. And but unlike the first seven chapters in Pookie and Little Bit Saga, this time the story will be told through the eyes of their son, Little Brother Man, who, well, in the story, is little no more.
He sure is.
Very interesting journey of a young man who has a bisexual father and a gay, father, because Mitchell is very much much more than just a godfather to Junior. So, and you see how that relationship blossomed over the years.
Yeah, and I really did follow it. I remember he and Mitchell were headed somewhere, and just how you wrote his character from a little boy perspective and how he pronounced Mitch Hull's name. And also the part you deal with, not just the theme of the love story, but you also dealt with themes of racism, because I do know from my own experience that, you know, there is racism within the gay culture. And you touch bases on it at one of the stores that Raheem was going to be doing a signing at as far as his modeling career. But you also touched bases about white gay life versus black gay life. Do you think anything has changed since, like, the early 90s with that division?
Well, not particularly, because gay still equals white in media presentations and depictions. And even when people of color are presented or profiled, nine times out of ten we are conveniently attached to a Caucasian.
Mm-hmm.
Or immersed in a white gay world. So, and of course it lends credence to the very racist notion that black people are more homophobic.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I deal with some of those particular themes in my short story collection, specifically the story of Friday Night Smackdown, in which an Afrocentric SGL activist and a white-identified black gay activist are at odds with each other. So, I mean, the century may have changed, and the political players and the stages in which we fight for our rights as STL people, but the racism and homophobia is just remixed.
I like how you put that. Food for thought. Before too much time gets away, can you feel what I'm saying is one of your story is one of three finalists in the LGBT erotica category for the 2013 Rainbow Awards? And I think that is just fantastic, and just congratulations. When will you know the outcome of that?
Yeah, thanks a lot. I believe the winners will be announced in December.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And you've won awards, I know, for the work you've done. But can you tell us a little bit about Can You Feel What I'm Saying?
Well, it is my first short story collection. It is, although most people tag it as erotica, it's more, in my eyes, an erotic collection, because it's not so much about the sex, but the context. The history. They say money makes the world go around. Well, really, sex does.
You could say that again.
You know, and so the characters bargain. They beg. they negotiate. they dance around it. They celebrate it. They dismiss it. There are a whole range of emotions and specific political, social, and cultural stations that are explored within it. And I do believe that, and I've gotten a lot of flack over the years, particularly from black STL men, for, I guess, being so graphic.
Oh, wow.
In my description. But, well, I don't believe that we should in any way feel shame or ashamed of being our sexual selves. That is definitely something to celebrate. So
I agree. I agree.
And I hope
with
that
you.
Can you what I'm saying does that.
Well, you know what? I could honestly say in reading your work, it's very tastefully done, and I agree. Sexuality is so much part of being a human being, and it's amazing how much stigma gets attached to, because, you know, the whole, and I won't even get into the whole religious thing, because that would take, like, probably hours to actually get through and talk about. But in how is B-Boy Blues, the play, doing? Where is it at right now?
We're doing very good, as Raheem would say. we're actually heading back to D.C. after our smashing sold-out performance at Howard University in June. We'll be at the Burke Theater at the Heritage Center on October 25th at 7 p.m. And the performance is co-produced by Alsora in D.C. So folks can actually go to Alsora's website, alsura.org, and click events, and B-Boy Blues, the play, will come right up. And, in fact, early bird tickets are still on sale until this Tuesday for $30 a piece. So get them while they're hot.
You know, indeed, and I'm jealous because I live over here on the West Coast, and I want to see the play. Or do you have any plans on having it come over here to the West Coast? I think I asked you when we were networking on Facebook.
Yeah, we are working on that. Folks got to understand that it takes a lot to put on a production like this, and then when you're talking about bringing it on the road,
oh yeah,
there's a lot of work involved. So, and we're also eyeing, hopefully sometime in the spring, an off-Broadway run. So that in particular, in terms of its success, will guarantee that there's a national and even an international tour. So
I'm just so proud of you. I'm proud of the story. Most certainly now, you know, this whole homophobe thing, it's just, when I look at our culture and I see where it came, I remember there was a club in Oakland called Bella Napoli. I frequented the San Francisco club, and it was predominantly white. Of course, you know, they had Donna Summer because, you know, that was the queen at the time. But when I got over to Bell Annapolis, it's a club that's not even there anymore, it was a little hole in the wall, and they were jamming the Mary Jane Girls' Candyman. And so it was just like an eye-opening experience for me being a gay man, because I really thought I was alone. But I most certainly enjoyed in your books how you described the culture. And so it wasn't just like a bunch of sex scenes in there. And so I'm wondering, how do you how does that transition onto like a stage?
Well, probably the most challenging aspect was whether or not the story would take place in 1993 or today.
Mm-hmm.
And I went back and forth on that because the story, for like so many other people, I have a soft spot for that specific time period. But it really doesn't matter, as many people have said after seeing the show, that it takes place today, because once again, it doesn't matter the century, it doesn't matter the fashions, the dance, the music. You know, Pookie and Little Bit's love is forever.
Mm-hmm.
And so once I got over that hurdle, everything just flowed naturally. And also, I'm sure when people see it, they're going to wonder, well, how come such and such isn't in the play? Well, you can't have half a thousand.
Right, exactly. I mean, it would be impossible to be like
a show. So
exactly, it would be if you did, it would probably be a 2-day event, and who knows, maybe one day that will happen. So I'm just so proud of you. I'm honored, number one, that you even accepted the invitation to be on A Touch of Grace, because again, I found you to be when I met you in Oakland at the Visible Live tribute to Ewan Harris, you and Stanley Bennett Clay. I just found you to be, and I always say this about you and how I describe you, your aura is as warm as a southern invitation to dinner. I just think you are just a beautiful human being, Jane Burrell. And so as I'm looking at the clock and seeing things wind down, I just want to ask this question for myself and on behalf of the listeners. What is next for James Earl Hardy?
Well, thank you so much for that affirmation. the eyes are on the prize for finally the film version of Be More Blue.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully maybe even a series.
Okay. All right, well, one thing I could honestly say, James, is that from the bottom of my heart, I really appreciate the voice that you gave me and the pride that you instilled in me being a gay black man. And I just think that you're one of God's very own. And I thank you for dropping by. And is there any final note that you want to get out to the listeners that are out there listening to this? And then also, I will go back and listen to the broadcast. Is there anything you want them to know about James Earl Hardy, the man?
Well, the one thing I would want them to know about themselves is that you are not a mistake. That you're supposed to be here and that you have a purpose. And sometimes your purpose is not what you think it is. And when that door is open for you to walk through, you might be a little suspicious of it, but remember that God has a plan. and you will indeed not only be surprised, but be blessed. Because when you're blessed, that means that you can pass the blessing on to others. And that's what Be More Blues and by extension this series has done for me and to me and for so many others. So I'm so thankful that I walked through that door.
Well, I just want to say that was beautiful. And anybody listening will certainly pick. I'm going to go back and actually listen to that. Because that's exactly how you hit my spirit and my soul. And you are just an incredible human being, James Earl. And I thank you for coming to A Touch of Grace. And I can't wait to see you again.
Well, thank you so much. Hopefully I'll be on that coast soon to promote Can You Feel What I'm Saying? And with B-Boy Blues the Play. And folks can definitely keep in contact with me on Facebook. B-Boy Blues the Play even has its own page as well as B-Boy Blues. So hit me up.
All right. Well, God bless you. You have a beautiful day and a continued successful run for B-Boy Blues to Play, James.
Thanks so much, mister.
All right. You take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's it, listeners. James Earl Hardy, again, he's everything that I have always said, just warm, charming, and incredible. So everybody, enjoy your weekend. And this is GD Grace saying thank you on behalf of A Touch of Grace.